many of you have probably had this experience as I get older. There are things that I have a harder and harder time actually reading and getting through. So I'm not a veteran. I'm certain I have not fired a weapon at a living thing, let alone a human being. Not probably struck someone in anger since fights in the playground when I was a little kid. So I'm sort of an odd spokesman for Veterans Day. I don't know if any of you watched the television show Firefly, but there's a character who's a doctor there, Simon Tam, who's obviously not the most belligerent person in the world. And people kept coming up to me while the show was saying, oh, you're here like him, you're like Simon Tam. And there was a wonderful scene in this movie where they're in a battle where everybody's shooting at one another and he's given a gun which he barely knows how to do anything with. He's trying his best he can, and at the end he's very shaken and he says to one of his much more battle-hardened compatriots, I've never shot anyone before. And the person, his friend, turns to him and says, trust me, you still haven't. So I feel that way. That said, I do have some connections here. My father was a Navy surgeon, and when I was 4 years old, he was sent off to Vietnam, where he was a surgeon on a floating hospital on the destroyer Iwo Jima off the coast of Vietnam. And when he came back, actually, the Navy flew us out to Hawaii. The naval bases on Hawaii flew us out on a propeller plane. Well, believe it or not, it was a cargo plane, Navy cargo plane with seats bolted to the floor on a 10-hour flight out to Hawaii. But out there, I saw for the first time the Pearl Harbor, monuments to Pearl Harbor and the sunken ships, and really had the first sense of the meaning of war. Just as an aside, Stensi's mother, Stensi's not here today, her father was a naval officer, and she was stationed at Pearl Harbor at the time. And has sometimes you can ask her, she has much more personal experience there. But when we came home, my father had an incredible collection of Technicolor slides he had taken of battle injuries. And I remember as a small child sitting in the back of the room as him showing his slides to his surgeon colleagues of these horribly injured people. As a kid, as a small child, I remember being horrified by this. There was just tremendous amounts of blood and shredded limbs. But I also remember being struck by the surgeons who were excited by this and saying, oh, what did you do then? Or how did you do this? And it was, for them, it was just a technical triumph and a tour de force. As a historical aside, silver lining is not a great idea, but one thing that does come from wars are some of the major advances in surgery. But as a child, this made an emotional impression on me that, to me, what I was looking at was all these blown up bodies, whereas for my father and his surgeon colleagues, this was an exciting professional challenge. When I was in high school, my father then gave me some of the best advice in my life. I was a proud child, and didn't like the idea of being financially dependent on my parents, and the idea occurred to me that I knew I could get a free ride to college because I could go to the Air Force Academy. I was pretty sure I would get in, and I'd heard of people doing this, and I thought, sure, I could do that. They'll pay my way. They'll give me a commission. I'll be an officer. And my father said, Robin, you do not take orders well. You do not belong in the academy. And it was very good advice. But for the good advice of my father, I might have had a very different and probably unhappy experience at the military academy. When I was in college, I didn't think much of war. The Vietnam War had ended, the draft had ended. I never expected to see veterans again. And thinking about it, in college, the only time we talked about war was with the great physicist Richard Feynman. I was at Caltech in Pasadena, and he was a physicist there. And my job as the vice president of my student house, one of my jobs was to invite faculty members over to dinner at the house, bake them cookies and entertain them and do all these things. And I got to meet a number of very eminent people. And we always liked to have Feynman over because he was such a character. Some of you may have read his books. He's a quite quite the colorful character. But he also described his time working for the Manhattan Project and working to build the first nuclear weapon. And he said that when they saw this thing go off, there was tremendous elation on the one hand, because again, it was an incredible technical triumph, a real triumph of just raw science to do this amazing thing. But then at the same time, this emotional feeling like it's all over now. There is just no way that this weapon is not going to be used. It's just a matter of time before we obliterate ourselves. So this would have been in the 1980 or so, at the depths of the Cold War. And he still felt that way at the time, that it was just really a matter of time, that there was no weapon that had ever been built that was not used. And now, even by then, there were many thousands of nuclear weapons. And he was quite pessimistic. He was optimistic in the short term, but quite pessimistic in the medium and the long term that we'd ever get out of this without incinerating ourselves. Otherwise, a relatively optimistic character, but I think that experience on many of the physicists who were involved thought this is the end. I went on to medical school after that, and again, didn't think much about war directly, but this was the 1980s at UC San Francisco as the AIDS epidemic overwhelmed the city. And the thought came to many of us, myself included, that this is like being in a war. Just wave upon wave of young men coming in, dying, and not being able to save them. And I had sort of expected, leaving college, that I would end up quietly working in the lab somewhere, worrying about genes and molecules, and not dying young men. But as I mentioned in a previous service, this kind of sort of forged who I am now. And I remember sitting by the bedside of quite a number of young men dying, thinking this is must be what it's like to be in war. I graduated from medical school and I came out here, and Stensi and I thought we would come out here and do our postdoctoral work and then go back to California. That would be 1990 now, so here we are, over 20 years later, we're still here. As part of medical training, the interns and residents while I was there were sent out to the Veterans Hospital, and I spent several months at the West Roxbury VA here. There, I don't know if you've ever been to the West Roxbury VA. It's actually quite a good facility and part of the wave of improvement in veterans hospitals. But one of the things they're most famous for is their spinal cord injury unit, and they have an entire wing of people mostly war injury people who are paralyzed and need care at various levels. And that, by this time, I was now old enough, I think, with enough maturity and empathy to see these people's lives forever altered. Most of these people then would have been Vietnam War veterans who were now in their 50s or so, who are now paraplegic, quadriplegic, and rendered dependent in various ways, and again had their lives fundamentally altered by the injuries they'd sustained in war. And I remember thinking at the time, how horrible, what a waste, how all these people with all these things that have happened to them in ways that we should have been able to avoid. That, if you remember, this was about the time of the first Iraq war, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And I have this vivid memory, this image of these paralyzed veterans watching these things happen on television. At the time, you may remember there was concern that that bacteriological warfare and chemical warfare might be used, and we were warned that people like me may be called up. Fortunately for me, that never happened. But I remember sitting with the people and thinking at that time, there's got to be a better way than this. It just cannot be the case. This is going to be our fate forever. But then, by that time, I was quite pessimistic too. There'd been just one thing after another. Looking back, I had missed some clues, and I think, looking back now, one of them I was too young to remember. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, 50th anniversary, which has just passed. We could have gone to war and didn't. Then in my lifetime, I could not see any way possible that the apartheid regime in South Africa would end except in horrifying bloodshed, but it did. And then as I grew up reading science fiction, and one of the repeated themes in science fiction is the nuclear apocalypse story. And when I was in medical school, by that time we had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. And I remember talking to the author, Douglas Hofstadter, about this, who came out to speak. Also just could not imagine how we were going to get out of the situation without a nuclear conflagration. But the Soviet Union dissolved with little bloodshed. And so I started to think, maybe it's not the case. Maybe this is not inevitable. Maybe this is not our fate. And I didn't know how to put these things together until last summer. I actually started it a year or so before, when I sort of became aware of this. The evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker, who is at Harvard Medical School and who's been actually kind enough to give some suggestions for some previous services that we've done here, and he said he's has written a book called "The Better Angels of Our Nature." And I want to come back to this at length in another service, but I want to leave you with this mental idea, which I think is extremely useful. And he says, we don't get to choose human nature. And we are left with pieces of human nature that are problematic and dangerous and harmful. But what we as thinking beings can do is to pit the better angels of our nature against the worst ones. For along with hatred and spite and envy, there is sympathy and empathy and a sense of fairness and justice and reason that are every much part of them. And we as thinking beings can build systems that try to hold the problematic parts in check by calling upon the good parts of human nature. So he wrote a book about this called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And again, I hope to come back to this at length. And I don't want to go into too much detail, except for the subject of Veterans Day, he makes the point that, say, he became aware of, that apparently is well known to historians but not to us, is that as horrifying as war has been in our time, actually the chance of being killed in a war over history has fallen and fallen and fallen and fallen from well over 10% in pre-civilization societies to tenfold less now, and a hundredfold less in Western Europe. And in the book, he details a number of reasons why this happens and what correlates with the fall in deaths due to warfare. Things like stable, honest government, things like commerce, international treaties, literacy, particularly literacy among girls. And not utopian things, but very practical things that one can imagine working on. And that actually made me very hopeful. Some people have misinterpreted this. They've misinterpreted this book, and he's gotten a lot of pushback against this. Not to say that war is not a problem. War is a horrible problem. Not to say that war is going to fade away by itself. It won't. But rather that war is not the inevitable destiny of mankind. And it's something that we can work on, something that we can make better, something that we can make, and war is something we can make more and more rare. Amazingly enough, even the most, in absolute terms, the most horrible conflagration in history, World War II, looked at as what fraction of the population were actually killed, is up there, but it's not the worst thing that's ever happened to mankind, and it's you know, in the top 10 somewhere. But even taking that into account, the fraction of people who died from wars in the 20th century is less than it was in the 17th century, and again, less than it was in the 13th century, and so on as you go back. So, you know, I take this as a hopeful sign that war is not inevitable, but also as a challenge to say, okay, if it's not our inevitable fate, then it becomes our duty to do something about it. So I'm an infectious diseases doctor, and this one thing I tell the students is that when I was a medical student, AIDS was a death sentence, and there was nothing you could do about it, and it was a scientific problem to try to figure out, you know, how the virus worked and what to do about it. Now we have medicines that can cure, or not cure, that can allow most people with HIV infection to live lives of normal lifespan. And I tell my students, I say, scientific progress converts tactical problems into moral problems. So now we have the tools, and now we need to show the will to use them. So I would say the same thing now about war. I think there is enough evidence now that we know the kind of things that will make it rare. And now we need to be willing to do the things, the difficult things, the expensive things, the sometimes scary things to make that true. It's certainly not an original thought to me, but I will leave you with that, with this idea that on Veterans Day, the most honorable thing we can do to honor veterans is to work for a world where we create fewer of them. May it be so.